This is The Choice, episode 13. Whiteness Conspiracy Theory, The Economics of Whiteness, part 1. I'm Kurt Doolittle. The history of human development consists of great leaps that were caused by repeated cycles of genetic isolation, adaptation, and later hybridization, with the hybrids almost always eradicating the prior generations. Most of our evolution consists of evolving increasing rates of adaptation faster than other competitors do. And the entire suite of body morphology, domestication, cooperation, intelligence, language, and technology have each rapidly improved our adaptability in sequence. Our early adaptation was to environmental conditions, changes in largely in the climate of Africa. Then we evolved into a super predator in those environmental conditions. Then we succeeded in domesticating ourselves to further the disproportionate gains that we could get from cooperating, and we developed language to increase the complexity of our cooperation, and then along the way the informal and formal institutions to increase the complexity of our cooperation and the strength of our competition, and then to use that combination of adaptations to domesticate plants, animals, and even one another for our mutual benefit. Domestication is made possible by reduction of aggression, producing in exchange an increase in cognitive agency, meaning patience, conscientiousness, and the ability to use our predictive intelligence in recursive trials or test runs in our minds that together assist us in improving adaptation further, in particular our ability to adapt cooperatively. Now, intelligence refers to, in the same context, nothing more than the rate of adaptation of the brain and mind to those conditions and stimulation. This is why the term intelligence is confusing to most people. It describes the rate of autoassociation, prediction, permutation, and recursion in the formation of increasingly deep associations between increasingly unrelated activities. This decreases friction of thought and limits the cost of energy and therefore the time that one can spend in adaptive thinking, meaning learning. So just as some of us are physically more fit and biomechanically superior to others, some of us are more cognitively fit and biomechanically superior to others. And just as some of us can't perform physical feats the way superior physical athletes can do, no matter how hard we try and train, some of us can't perform superior cognitive feats the way cognitive athletes do, no matter how hard we try. But in general, in the norm, meaning in ordinary life, most of us can get through the normative challenges of life without having to be either physical or cognitive elites. And this matters because most of life consists of things in the middle, not at the extremes. What's important about this is that as we evolve more and more complex society, using more and more adaptability, adapting more quickly, using more technology to adapt more quickly, working with increasingly complex things that take longer and are harder to learn, that the norm, in other words, what is the middle where most people have to operate in order to cooperate in this particular environment varies. So what we need intellectually in different stages of evolution, in other words, the rate of which our mental and physical adaptation is sufficient, varies by the degree of sophistication of our civilizations. All groups evolve in the direction of domestication. That's what I'm going to use and we should use as the evolution of human beings. That is the direction of human evolution ever since we achieved fully physical modern humans. Since then, we've been largely evolving towards domestication, which furthers cooperation. That's because domestication is produced by neoteny and the resulting pedomorphism, and all groups vary in their degree of domestication and degree of neoteny. That's the primary difference between groups. All groups practice a group evolutionary strategy as well, and that strategy reflects their degree of self-domestication, their geography, their means of production, their homogeneity or heterogeneity, and whether or not they have local competitors. All groups have adapted to that evolutionary strategy in competition with other groups. And all groups, except for those who maybe read my work, are largely unaware of their strategy. Instead, they assume that behavior of the universe, nature, the polity, society, individuals, and what's the good or bad, they do this without reflection. It's just habit and intuition. It's where our intuitions come from. It's one of the reasons people in different civilizations or cultures, we have different intuitions about what's right and wrong. It's not rational. It's inherited. The strategy varies by race, civilization, nation, class, and sex. Within each nation, civilization, and race, each group's strategies tends to be approximately internally consistent, meaning it evolved to assist the people at every level of that class within the civilizational hierarchy to cooperate with each other while cooperating with and competing successfully against others. But, interestingly, these group strategies differ quite a bit in the consistency with and correspondence to the formal, meaning logical, physical, natural, meaning behavioral, and evolutionary laws of the universe. Some are more consistent, correspondent, and coherent with the formal, physical, natural, and evolutionary laws, and some are less so, and some are quite antithetical to them. And this is one of the things that we're going to talk about, since adaptation to those laws, the degree with which you adapt to or diverge from them, will determine the rate of your adaptation and your relative position in civilizational hierarchies. Europeans, it appears, are the newest macro subrace, formed about 5,000 years ago by the hybridization of European hunter-gatherers, Anatolian farmers, and steppe herders, with the steppe herders the inheritors of the most recent race to evolve, the ancestral North Eurasians, who themselves hybridized and gave us both Europeans and Amerindians, as well as others. As a side note, the Ashkenazi might be the newest hybrid subrace at around 600 to 700 years old by interbreeding with European females, practicing upward redistribution of reproduction to their best and brightest, meaning their teachers or rabbis, and then being pressured through genetic bottlenecks as they were ostracized from polity after polity for specializing in the organized crime against the commons, using their skill at baiting into hazard, something that we'll explore in detail elsewhere. Because of these European steppe herders, for reasons we'll address again elsewhere, Europeans evolved to discover, adapt to, and apply the physical, natural, and evolutionary laws of the universe, including continuing natural selection by using their ancient law of self-determination, using sovereignty, reciprocity, and the resulting markets. Markets, in fact, do, if we don't do redistribution, markets persist natural selection by selecting people out of those groups for reproduction that can't survive competition in those markets. In other words, these steppe herders domesticating horse, cattle, and sheep then turn to domesticate humans that they'd conquered, like they had domesticated every other animal, and set about domesticating the natural world for fun and profit as well. The unconscious, unintentional, and purely accidental novelty of these steppe herders was in creating a fully militarized people, functioning purely entrepreneurially in the absence of a central authority, limited to rule of law of meritus tort, meaning property, thereby bypassing the religious and state phases of development, both of which, like all bureaucratic systems, will always and ever everywhere produce falsehoods and corruption and rent-seeking and the resulting stagnation and mistrust. Instead, by the use of markets in every aspect of life, they fostered competition to discover optimums, the formal, physical, logical, and evolutionary laws of the universe. And not necessarily as intellectual insights, but as an entirely unintentional byproduct of their social, legal, and political order. And there's these people have to value these particular insights. They just maintained their their group strategy, and their group strategy as a byproduct produced higher rates of adaptation. Conformity to the physical, natural, and evolutionary laws, using, again, sovereignty, reciprocity, and markets in all walks of life, provides an adaptive advantage by reducing frictions of opportunity costs, risks, rent-seeking, and corruption. And it hinders the formation of stagnation by the continuous formation and reformation of Pareto distributions within those markets, including the competition between elites, so that we have a long history of the martial aristocracy, the feminine priesthood, and the neutral law eventually becoming the patron saint, so to speak, of the middle class. And so this hinders the formation of stagnation by the continuous reformation of Pareto distributions within those markets, but that comes at a cost, and it's a cost most won't pay. It's the cost of suppressing the reproduction of the unfit, where the unfit are self-selected by demonstrating their incapacity for self-determination by self-sufficiency in markets, so that when the early Europeans conquered a people, they formed an upper class that maintained this rule, and then they allowed people in who, through the process of slave, serf, freeman, citizen, etc., to go in by merit. And so this was essentially a process of domesticating man, just like they domesticated other animals. And this is the fundamental problem of Western civilization. This is what we do and made us successful, but once we bring about democracy, it's no longer polite or politically useful to be able to say the truth about what got us here. So, in other words, Europeans evolved by accident of their original military and economic order such that they were slowly evolved what we would call scientific civilization with the fewest impediments to adaptation. Now, religion, on the other hand, adapts very slowly, and that's why people use it. It resists adaptation. It is in favor of the lower classes who are least able to adapt, and it is in favor of a priesthood that can exploit this inability of those people to adapt to profit from their positions. The state calcifies and adapts slightly less slowly because bureaucracies also are self-interested and tend to self-perpetuate at this cost of the people that they're governing. But self-organizing civilizations, I mean organized without authority or pretense by rule of law, adapt more quickly, and European rule of law adapts as soon as either someone innovates in reciprocity, meaning in the market, and competes successfully with it, or someone innovates in irreciprocity and is taken to court over it. Because the moment a case is decided in court, we've discovered a brand new application of the law, something you may not do, without government or religious interference, and it's purely empirical and it's entirely immediate. The same is true for innovations. You don't need permission to put out an innovation. Though in history we've seen this crop up as often as possible, you don't need to put out an innovation. Matter of fact, most constraints in history are about trying to prevent people from coming in with poorer quality works that would actually crash the comparative advantage of people who are producing high quality crafts. Europeans alone pay the high cost of self-determination by sovereignty or in reciprocity in what we call display word and deed, mean everything humans can do, especially A, the personal high cost of testimonial speech or scientific speech in public speech, regardless of cost to the dominance hierarchy. Europeans are the only people to take their original law and their law of testimony and their practice of military reporting, which is highly empirical, and turn that into, by using the military and the hierarchy, push the norm of testimonial speech further and further down into the population. At this point, by the 1900s, Europeans had largely pressed testimonial speech as a norm down into every action of society, and it's why that European lower working and middle classes, and sometimes the upper middle classes, are the most valuable middle class in the world, because they are the only middle classes, in other words, above the very low and below the very high, they're the only people in the world who don't engage in systemic attempts at parasitism and predation by use of the state. It's this invasion of people that do try to engage in parasitism by the state that are making it impossible for these Europeans to continue their tradition of testimonial speech and non-parasitism. Secondly, or B, we have the duty to commons before the self. This means that heroism is practiced and virtue is earned by duty to the commons before self or family. So testimonial speech, truth before face, is completely alien to the rest of the world. They usually do face before truth, or in the Middle East, lie before anything. Europeans do commons before self and family, whereas all the rest of the world puts either small community first, family first, or self first. These two things are antithetical to the rest of the world. Item C is we use this direction of dominance to heroism for the benefit of the commons rather than self, family, or kin. And in doing so, we generate this the desire for everyone to be heroic, which is constantly contributing to commons rather than be heroic to one's family and at the expense of the commons. So these few things are extremely difficult to do and impossible to indoctrinate unless you use the combination of everyone's in the military, therefore your status is obtained by that. Everyone has access to heroism and status and is given status for contribution to the commons, and everyone is lionized for paying the high cost of testimonial speech and treating everyone else with reciprocity, as well as what we've been deprived of is the defense of the commons from people who would break these rules. As such, Europeans evolved the lowest corruption, lowest crime, greatest trust, and highest economic velocity, and highest innovative velocity, despite small numbers on the edge of the Bronze Age and the Bronze Age Revolution that they mastered, creating the Indo-European expansion. But European group strategy is a continuous adaptation, and it's extremely costly, and no other people succeeded in doing it save perhaps the Japanese, who we admire. And so Europeans, meaning whites, earn their advantages in adaptation every single day by paying the costs we don't see, by not taking personal gains that the rest of the world would normally do. So we pay for our advanced civilization by what we don't do as much as what we do do. So while the left uses the term whiteness without grasping its meaning, they're referring to the group strategy of the European people that's 5,000 years old. The group strategy of the European people is an advancement in evolution and an evolutionary velocity because of the cooperative advancement in adaptive velocity. That group strategy is more adaptive because it's the most conformal with formal, logical, physical, natural, and evolutionary laws, despite the fact that we must pay for that conformity to those laws. So really, whiteness just equals science. Science equals truthful testimony, and no other people institutionalized empirical truth before face regardless of cost, duty before self regardless of cost, or commons before self and family regardless of cost by the militarization of the entire society so that no matter what rank you have, your due respect for doing your duty, for adherence to our laws and the laws of the universe. This adherence grants the entire population the extraordinary benefits of more rapid adaptation to the changes in the universe, the environment, and in our knowledge, and the forcible transformation of the universe to fit the needs of man. So this is why it doesn't matter if whites were first, Europeans discovered first, well, we discovered this first or that first. Well, first of all, we discovered almost everything first, and if we didn't, we evolved it faster. So even if Europeans were smaller in number or that we were poorer in wealth at any given time, by specializing in greater evolutionary adaptability, Europeans were first with all but the margins and then passed all other civilizations from behind in just a few centuries in the Bronze Age, a few centuries in the Iron Age, a few centuries in the Steel or Modern Age, and the only delay in our evolutionary excellence has been the Bronze Age collapse, which we might have caused, the Jewish, Christian, and Muslim Dark Ages of superstitious ignorance, and now the New Age of Jewish sophistry and pseudoscience begun in the last century as the revolt against such people as Darwin, Menger, Nietzsche, and Spencer. In fact, the entire modern period that threatened their investment movement and superstition, free riding, non-productivity, and parasitism on host peoples, like the priests they're emulating. So populations that have failed to adapt to the laws of the universe, well, they claim whites are oppressors, rather than the painful truth that the universe is frankly uncaring, and only whites, Europeans, are willing to pay the cost of adapting to it, and all other people want the gains of living with and under white civilization without themselves paying the same costs of full integration into that civilization by paying all those unseen costs. Why? Because their demographic distributions are insufficiently domesticated to compete in an advanced society against Europeans without dragging Europeans down to their own level by continuous undermining, by taking advantage of the fragility that a high-trust, high-tolerance civilization is exposed to by its very foundations. So QED, anti-whiteness, is an anti-scientific or an unscientific conspiracy theory. It's an attempt at theft by fraud at the sub-race, race, and civilizational scale. At a small scale, we might call it an organized crime. At a large scale, it's basically war. The problem is the Europeans have domesticated war so that we've forgotten that war can be conducted on all these different fronts by all these different means. So our concept of war is a military endeavor, except that that isn't how it's done. Especially the Chinese, the Jews, and the Muslims conduct war by non-military means. Chinese do it by delay and deceive while they build up capital, and the Jews and Muslims do it by delay and deceive while they undermine. These are the same strategies of avoiding military conflict while undermining the civilization either from within, as the Jews and Muslims do, or from without, as the Chinese do. Both of these organizations work somewhat like the Borg. The Chinese thankfully indoctrinate conquered people into the Chinese Empire. They use forcible conversion to turn them into what they call themselves Han, even though they're not. And the Jews and Muslims, Jews undermine and try to maintain separatism, but the Muslims come in and they destroy this civilization hook, line, and sinker by destroying the institutions, its arts, its literature, its knowledge, reducing everybody to pandering ignorance, and by downward distribution of reproduction, reduce it to genetic ashes. So we have a great vulnerability because our definition of war is war as we conduct with each other on our terms by not undermining, by not delaying and deceiving, by settling things quickly as we would in court, because our war is just, again, another expression of our system of law. When other people don't do this, so you see the Jewish and Muslim means of destruction, and you see the Catholic, the Church's attempt to do it to primitive people as well, although we have to give the Christian Church a little credit now and then. And then we see the Chinese, on the other hand, doing it. And again, the Chinese, it's hard to argue with because they're able to conquer, domesticate, forcibly integrate, and homogenize a bunch of people into Chinese civilization. What's happened with us is because we're so forgiving, the minute we go outside our boundaries, we're destroyed by people. So the only times we've been successful is when Europeans have moved into the European territory, conquering the previously settled Neolithic farmers from Anatolia, and then when we conquered the rest of the world and decimated the populations. Whenever we've gone into India, or when Persians have tried to go into Arabia, the result has been cancerous because not willing to use the same depth of warfare and the same kind of warfare that other people use, primarily because we're not capable of it. That kind of deception is antithetical to our institutions. So the weakness in a high-trust society is the high-trust and self-determination produce extraordinarily high tolerance. This high tolerance for self-determination, letting people make their own choices, also allows for baiting into hazard and guilting into hazard. Well, this baiting men into hazard and guilting women into hazard. The whiteness conspiracy theory attempts to exploit this by denying the obvious, which is others' unfitness for the advanced civilization we've constructed. Unfitness is, again, the failure to or inability to adapt to the physical, scarcity, natural, meaning reciprocity and amorality, the evolutionary, meaning ethnocentrism, regression to the mean, and the race of the Red Queen. And anti-whiteness is just another attempt to avoid reform and avoid paying the costs of reform once you're aware of culture's values. So it's one thing to say that we didn't know and we're just following our group's evolutionary strategy, but it's quite another one to, once you're aware of the fact that you're engaging in organized crime and you're engaging in warfare against the host population that's trying to domesticate you, once you were aware of it and you don't change, then that's just an intentional act of war. So whiteness is a test of genetic fitness in an increasingly safe, prosperous evolutionary civilization because we continue natural selection using self-determination by sovereignty, reciprocity, and adversarial markets, meaning the absence of authority, that maximizes the rate of adaptation and maximizes prosperity without intentional design. So just as we can say the universe isn't intentionally designed, European civilization is intentionally designed. We just do what we've inherited, and my job has largely been to explain what it is we've inherited and why we're so disproportionately successful in the three great ages of man. Every objection to whiteness is then an objection to the fact that the gains of white civilization are produced by conformity to the laws of the universe, or in religious terms, the laws of nature and nature's God, including the law of natural selection, except we use market eugenics now that we're not bound so strongly by the environment. And those that object cannot compete and have failed nature and nature's God, and those complainers want the benefits of adhering to the law of nature and nature's God, or to steal from whites and drag whites down with them in violation of the laws of nature and nature's God. The difference between classes is genetic load, or defect. We are, unfortunately, unwilling to solve the social, economic, political, and evolutionary problem of those with, quote, birth defects, those unable or unwilling to conform to whiteness, the physical, natural, and evolutionary laws. The solution, of course, is to take care of them despite their behavioral birth defects, but prohibit their reproduction, thereby ending that chain of defects. Now, you may try to find fault with these arguments because they're unpleasant, but truth and pleasantness aren't synonymous. But you won't be able to. All you can do is lie and deny about them, which is the group strategy of the left and the argumentative technique of the Abrahamic method of deceit upon which the three great monotheistic religions are constructed and upon which the Marxist, neo-Marxist, postmodernist, anti-male feminist, and HBD denialist and woke movements are dependent. They're dependent on guilting Western civilization in our naivety for not understanding our actual group strategy and taking advantage of that weakness in our law of self-determination. Instead, to create first the Abrahamic method of deceit and the monotheistic religions, and second, to create the pseudoscientific version of them that I just listed. So group differences are the result of genetic load, defects, so more so than genetic behavioral advantage. In other words, it means that domestication is one thing. We can accelerate any group more by reducing the size of its underclasses and allowing the norms and behaviors to rise up the chain of the hierarchy. We're better to do that than we are to try to physically manipulate gene pools. Matter of fact, we don't really have to do anything except that, because that will produce the same ends for the largest number of people without creating the chaos of genetic manipulation or the risk of doing so. So if equally evolved and neotenically fully integrated, without exception and in the single-digit percentages, the genetically upper and lower upper classes of other groups, meaning races or subraces, can in fact participate in our high-trust civilization. Otherwise they can't, and they're below those upper classes, they certainly can't. Not just theoretically, not just logically, but demonstrably. Even East Asians, the Han, Korean, and Japanese, are now that they're a measurable minority, are pressing for group-specific benefits and resisting full integration. Another example of their racism. A proof of universal racism is simple. Whiteness is a text of genetic fitness for our high trust, truth before face, commons before self or family, increasingly safe, prosperous evolutionary civilization. The problem is that because all people are in fact racist, in other words, they practice and favor kin selection at all times, they are unwilling to evolve their group by suppression of their underclass reproduction. In other words, the way we would know people weren't racist is if they actually suppressed their underclass reproduction. The fact that they won't equally suppressed, that is how we know they're racist. Multiculturalism can't succeed because whites can't afford and will lose the incentives to continue to pay for the high cost of impulse suppression, high trust commons, economic velocity, and evolutionary adaptability, while bearing the burden of suppressing their behavior and reproduction in order to pay for those that cannot genetically or culturally compete, meaning survive, because their in-group, meaning their race, culture, religion, preference is higher than their reform and adaptivity preference, preference and the preference for those gains. So they engage instead in undermining and parasitism by the IELT anti-white conspiracy theory. Lesser humans, and I use that term as an objective judgment, can distance yourselves from formal science, meaning the logics, the physical sciences, but you can't really do so from the behavioral, meaning language, psychology, sociology, economics, law, politics, and war, and the evolutionary sciences either, which are group strategy under evolutionary pressure. You just can't escape those things because they destroy the little comforting lies. Now, you can tell yourself little comforting lies about the physical world, but it's increasingly difficult to do so as we move up the complexity chain. I'm equally capable and do describe all group evolutionary strategies of all cultures in equally scientific terms. The ones I try to focus on are the Europeans, so I can make people aware of why they're successful so they can defend against the crimes against their people, and the Jewish and Muslim, because both survive only by parasitically exploiting the weakness in higher trust, more productive, more evolved civilizations. As such, Judaism and Islam are anti-science, anti-evolutionary attempts to undermine, rallying equally a maladaptive of people to drag others into equal failure because they cannot or will not adapt to the laws of the universe, or, as we say, nature and nature's God. Christianity, not to leave it out, is equally devolutionary and communist, but it had to be Germanized in order to convert the Europeans. Well, the aristocracy then used the church as a holding company under primogeniture, meaning that if I had, say, four sons, only one of them would inherit, thus keeping the territory together, and there, maybe some others might go off elsewhere, and then one or two would go into the church, but then we would buy land or acquire land and give it to the church, thus forming a holding company under primogeniture, so that both the lands would remain under the control of the nobility, whether under the aristocracy or the church, and then be rented out to people, and the noble families would stay in charge. Given this domesticated the church. It wasn't able to really get away with, or it couldn't go full communist like the Jews and the Muslims. This is why the Catholic Church has gone full communist in this century. The Europeans have abandoned it and politically ostracized it, economically isolated, and so, as you can see from the current Pope, has reverted to a form as a Semitic cult of undermining the adaptation to law, to the laws of nature and nature's God, and it's seeking to maintain its revenue based as a parasitic group that maintains a superstitious primitive people forms a rent-seeking bureaucracy over them. Now, I can list a whole series of very popular practitioners of the Semitic counter-revolutionary Jewish female group strategy of undermining alphas, seeking attention and reward in exchange for casting whiteness as oppressors, who is a proxy for hating the nature and nature's God. I have started to write a few essays or articles, and I will make some podcasts trying to show you how public intellectuals are using this strategy to destroy Europeans. Once you see it, you sort of can't unsee it, and that's one of the things I want to bring to normal people. It's one thing for me to try to educate a new group of social scientists and build a new judiciary, but trying to reach normal people is somewhat difficult with the technical methodology, so this is one way I feel I can reach people by example. So, to get this around, Europeans, whites, practice whiteness, meaning science. And so we just need to stop trying to convince liars and criminals and people at war with us to stop selling lies and stealing and seeking rent and undermining. Instead, as I recommend, I don't recommend doing what we've done in the past, which is go to war and exterminate them all or export them, but instead we can expand the law against false promises or fraud, conspiracy, sedition, and we can just prosecute people under that law until they adapt, depart, or must be physically removed. Because frankly, in all of human history, the most intolerant wins, and we need to be the most intolerant. This is Kurt Doolittle for the Propertarian Institute. This is The Choice. Thank you for listening.